Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 25 years of law enforcement analysis experience. She's an instructor for the Joint Military Intel Training Center and Marymount University. She's earned numerous awards with the Defense Intelligence Agency, the International Association of Law Enforcement Analysis, and the International Association for Intelligence Education. She's an expert in indicators for money laundering. She's the author of many publications, including two books, Applications in Criminal Analysis, a source book, and Applications in Intelligence-Led Policing, where theory meets reality. She's developed many courses for law enforcement analysis, and she's a newspaper reporter turned working for politician turned being a contractor for the Pennsylvania Crime Commission. Needless to say, she is a great influencer to the law enforcement analysis profession. Please welcome Marilyn Peterson. Marilyn, how are we doing?
We are just great. How are you, Jason?
I am doing well, and I'm always happy to talk to a fellow Pennsylvanian. So thank you so much for being on the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay. So I normally start with my guest how they discovered the law enforcement analysis profession, but you wanted to actually start quite a bit a ways earlier in your life before you got into law enforcement. So let's start there.
Okay. So I just wanted to mention that I was a foster child from the time I was a few weeks old until I aged out of the system, as they call it, at age 18. I lived in a rural setting with a family who had not progressed past eighth grade in education, and I loved to read, and I read through my entire childhood. I just read. The most important influencers in my life at that time were teachers, and I have a feeling that that is why when I went to college, I wanted to major in education, but did not, but actually did end up teaching in many countries and in many formats, many courses. So it all kind of comes out in a sensible way.
Yeah. Did you ever contact your parents?
My real parents?
Yes.
Biologic? My dad used to come out and drive out from Philadelphia and visit me maybe once or twice a year, and he'd always take me out for chocolate ice cream. My mother, on the other hand, they were divorced, kind of, and was known for being an alcoholic and very irresponsible. I was not allowed to meet her until I was 12. It was not a happy meeting, and I've never really had a good relationship with her.
When you get into college, then, what are you studying and what do you hope to be coming out of high school into college?
Well, when I left high school, I wanted to be a teacher, and I went to Temple University in Philadelphia and talked with them about education courses. But they told me that because I was partly deaf or hearing impaired, as it's now called, that I would not be suitable for teaching in any public school system. So I switched over to, I was in political science for a while. I was in law for a while, pre-law, that is. I ended up in social work, and that's the last thing I majored in before I got married, and my husband, who was in law school, and I married because, well, we didn't marry because he graduated, but we left town because he graduated from law school and went to a lovely little village called Warren, Pennsylvania, which is up near the Kinzu Forest and about 50 miles southeast of Erie.
Yeah, now you're really close to my neck of the woods. I was born in Meadville, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So, yes.
Meadville was a very big oil and gas area, as I recall.
Yes, yes, and very popular with tool and die these days.
While I lived in Warren, Pennsylvania, I actually considered applying to Mercyhurst College because it was the nearest school. I was going to go after a degree in education, but then my husband got a job with the National Labor Relations Board in Cincinnati, and so we moved to Cincinnati. That was kind of the end of that. But while I was there, I was doing some work in social work with the Head Start program. That's a preschool program, and I just love children who are like from 4 to 7. So sweet and say the cutest things, and I really wanted to work with them, and that was kind of some of the people that were in the Head Start program. But when we moved to Cincinnati, I at one point applied to the UC there, but we moved again. In fact, the time I was married to my first husband, we moved 9 times in 12 years.
Oh, wow.
So I couldn't really get my feet settled anywhere, but I did an awful lot of redecorating and curtain sewing. How did I then get with the Pennsylvania Crime Commission? Well, I ended my marriage in 1978, and then I was working for a very small weekly newspaper called the Chestnut Hill Local, but I also did some articles for the Evening Bulletin, which is now defunct. I was covering politics and government for the local, and it was a very popular topic in Chestnut Hill, so I had a lot of fun with that. I really enjoyed newspaper reporting, but being what they call a stringer, well, let me put it this way. The first article I did, I got $4 for.
Oh, wow.
Needless to say, that was not exactly enough to put me as a divorced mother of a child that was about 8. You know, did not put me in a happy place. So I found out that some folks that I knew were doing a political commission on SEPTA, which is a Southeast Pennsylvania Transportation Authority. And I was hired by them to be the research person for the Democratic side, although it was the Republican side that actually found me that job. From there, I went on to the Pennsylvania Crime Commission in 1980. As a contractor, I was hired to help write a book called A Decade of Organized Crime. I don't know if in your travels in Pennsylvania, you ever saw that book, Jason?
No, I didn't. I have not seen that book.
Okay. It was a lot of fun because we had April, May, June, and only 2 weeks in April to do it. It ended up being 278 pages. Oh, we didn't have computers then.
It's all typewriter, huh?
Yeah, lots of fun. But it was all about organized crime. I ended up being the chief writer.
Interesting. So what was the most significant lesson learned from that report?
The most significant lesson learned, I love research. and it was just so much fun. I was working 60, 70 hours a week and just loving it.
Wow.
I love projects that I can really dive into. And I didn't know anything at all about organized crime.
Right, yeah.
I started, but it was a very fun project, probably the most fun of anything I've ever done.
All right.
In my career. So I was happy with that.
And what were some of the conclusions that were made from that report?
Well, some of the conclusions were things like the organized crime is not limited to La Cosa Nostra.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a chapter in the book on the Black Mafia. We had a chapter in the book on outlaw motorcycle gangs. We had a chapter on white collar crime. And we could see that there was this trend away from the mafia, that there were many different kinds of ethnic groups that had definitely crime activity going on. And so that was very interesting to find because, of course, in the 50s and 60s, everything was the mafia. Aside from that, conclusions. Well, my own personal conclusion
there you go.
Was that there were a certain number of ties between politics and organized crime. I saw firsthand, one thing we did was we brought the book out at a session of the legislature in Harrisburg. One of the fellows who was in the legislature, whose name will go on unsaid here, bugging us ahead of time. He wanted to see an advance copy. He wanted to see an advance copy. And we were keeping it very much under wraps. I mean, they had like police guards guarding the copies of it and all, because we had published 10,000 copies. And this fellow kept bugging us and bugging us. And finally, we gave each of the people who were on the Judiciary Committee, including him, a copy of the book. And he immediately turned to the index and looked in the index to see if his name was there. And this huge wash of relief came across his face. I was watching him at the time.
Bad poker player, huh?
Yeah.
So as you're telling the story and as you're talking about your childhood, about loving to read and loving to do the research and then really get into writing, I would think that all of those things really have helped you with your career in law enforcement analysis. I always think when I talk to younger folks about getting into the field that almost every application that you're going to fill out is going to have something on writing and something on oral communication.
Absolutely. I think that the fact that I love to read and I do read fairly quickly really helped me. I have a great love of history. I was a very good history student in high school and college. I really just enjoy diving into things. When I was a newspaper reporter, all of the politicians, people running for governor, Senate, etc., that I interviewed, I was only allowed 1 hour with them. And sometimes it was 1 hour sitting across from them in a limousine on their way to their next speaking engagement. So it was challenging, but I found that it was very good to do a certain amount of research ahead of time so that I didn't ask any really stupid questions.
Very good. Yeah, I'm always worried about that myself as I'm doing this show.
I hear you.
So then you eventually become an analyst with the Middle Atlantic Great Lakes Organized Crime Law Enforcement Network, also known as McLaughlin, which that is the best abbreviation name out there of all these. Isn't that a risk center as well?
Yeah, so Pennsylvania Crime Commission had gotten the grant to organize McLaughlin. They needed to do that fairly quickly. And so I was pulled off of some other work that I was doing for them to gather people for a stand-up meeting on that from whatever law enforcement agencies we could find. I also, a couple months later, was sent off to beautiful Georgia to take the Anacapa Sciences 1 week analytic investigations in methods course. Glenn Ridgway, who has become a lifelong friend, was the teacher of that at the time on behalf of Anacapa. So when I returned back to the agency, the Pennsylvania Crime Commission, and opened the door to this very small room in the middle of one of their buildings, McLaughlin opened its door. We were officially in session. I had been named senior analyst, so that people felt that someone who knew what they were doing was in charge. Ha ha. So McLaughlin started June 18th of 1981. I was there for 7 years and I helped establish its database. I helped establish a cadre of analysts there. We had a luxury at the time and probably still now. We had data analysts who were required to do all of the data entry for us. So when we got 40,000 toll records from telephone calls, you know, it would take them 4 to 6 months to enter them rather than the analysts having to do that. Phew. So McLaughlin, we also did a bunch of training. We developed courses. I developed analytic courses. While I was there, we put on a number of interesting conferences that I was involved in creating and generating. It was a very busy time.
What was your inspiration behind doing all this? Because you're coming in to this position. Did you have a vision right away? Or again, you're reading and researching, and as you're gathering all these different sources, developing as you go?
It was an as-you-go kind of thing, James. Mm-hmm. I found it probably was not until I was in the field maybe 5 years before I realized that I was totally committed to it and would want to spend my life doing it. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting process, but I loved the fact that I was constantly doing something different. Every case is different. Every analysis is different. And at the time, there were very few written products saying how things should be done. So the first article that I wrote was for the IALEA newsletter, which was not called the IntelliScope at the time, but it was about telephone record analysis. And I, because that was one of the big things that analysts had to do in those days, and we were doing it off of records that were gotten from telephone companies. We were using 3x5 index cards for each number that was called and then putting down the dates and times of the calls that were made to them or by them on the card. It was an extremely laborious thing.
Sounds like it.
At the time, Pennsylvania and New Jersey were somewhat close, as they still are. I sent a copy of it to my friend who was kind of the lead analyst at New Jersey, who was Paul Andrews Jr. And Paul and I proceeded to do a book together in 1990 called Criminal Intelligence Analysis. But I sent it over to Paul and asked for his feedback. And he had said to me, "I will look forward to giving you feedback. I'll tell you everything you did wrong." So, needless to say, I was a little apprehensive since this was the first thing about analysis that I had ever written. Mm-hmm. And I was just waiting for the boom to fall. But sure. Weeks went by after it was published in the newsletter, and I had heard nothing from Paul. And I finally gave up and called him and said, "Well, what did you think?" And he said, "Oh, it was fine."
All that worrying for nothing.
Exactly. And that's something that taught me, you know, talk about lessons learned. You know, that's something that taught me to write what I thought was right and let the chips fall.
Sure. What kind of cases are you working on at this time? Is this organized crime, or are you into various types of crime when you're doing the telephone toll analysis and all the work for McLaughlin?
Well, McLaughlin at the time did not have the over 1,000 agencies as members as it now has. When I started, I think we had 8 agencies, and then it went to 11. So we felt like we were really progressing. But we were getting cases from state and county and local agencies. So whatever they needed us to do, we would figure out a way to do it. And that's what we would tell them in our training. You know, if it's on paper, we can create some kind of database to put it into and we'll be fine. you know, we became computerized. Lachlan started in 81. By 84, we had a computer that was absurd by today's standards, but it was enough that we could create little databases for things like toll records or financial records or surveillance records and so forth. And we were getting cases like bankruptcy fraud, medical fraud, organized crime, yeah, but there were a lot of other ones. I remember one from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, I think of that area, maybe the DA's office out there that wanted us to look at when certain crimes were occurring based on what the moon was doing at the time.
Oh, okay.
So we had to track that kind of stuff. So it was kind of a mix of crime analysis and intelligence analysis, Jason. And, you know, I would tell people when I was training them, because I started teaching in 84 or 85, I would tell them that an analyst has to be able to play pickup ball. Whatever is needed doing, they need to be able to do. So you have to, you know, be willing to try a bunch of different things. And we did.
So then during your time here as well, you develop a computerized criminal index. Can you describe that for our audience?
It was what we call a pointer index. It was a 5x8 card starting out where people could put the name and the aliases of the person and typical PII information, you know, date of birth, place of birth, any scars or tattoos or whatever, what kinds of crimes they had been convicted of or were suspected of. When we just had that on cards at the Pennsylvania Crime Commission, we had these giant card veyors that were like something out of some strange Frankenstein kind of movie. Had millions and millions of cards, and you could look people up by their name or their alias or the type of crime they were involved in. That was about it. Mm-hmm. So when we went to the computerized, you know, we wanted to give people, you know, more than that. We wanted to give them the geography and the temporal, you know, whatever we knew about the person. But we abided by 28 CFR 2320, mm-hmm. which is the Code of Federal Regulations, Criminal Intelligence Guidelines. At one time, I think I had them memorized because we had to teach them to our agencies as well as abide by them. But it was very much, you know, that you couldn't put somebody in unless they were reasonably suspected of being involved in crime. And, you know, you had, you know, a decent reason for doing that, not just that they were a family member. You know, we had lawyers who were sitting on top of us saying, you know, you don't put people in just because they're related. You put them in because they're involved in some type of criminal pursuit. And so we were always very conscious of the privacy and the human rights issues mm-hmm. of our files. When we started in 80, there were some agencies, for example, the Michigan State Police was barred by their state from joining McLaughlin because they were not allowed to share criminal intelligence information with other agencies because of things that had been done, you know, files that they had kept and et cetera in the past. So we were very cognizant of that.
In terms of this project, then, what were the challenges for this project? I mean, was it the source material? Was it the data entry? Was it the format of the computer program?
Well, I would say that the hardest thing was overcoming the concerns that the police officers had the analysts were not sworn. There were some police officers who said, we will lose our pension if we give you data. So they actually did swear us in, at least they swore me in, because I was responsible for the analytic and database effort. It was like we were sworn in, but we weren't sworn in to carry guns or arrest people.
Mm-hmm.
Good thing.
Yeah, that's just another thing you got to worry about, right? You know, you got enough on your plate.
Exactly. And yeah, when I first went to work for the Pennsylvania Crime Commission, and everyone of the officers there, agents, were wearing guns, I was very nervous because I had not really been around guns, and I had not really, you know, had any run-ins with people in the military or the police, and it scared me a lot. And I finally gave up and went and took lessons on shooting and actually purchased a gun so that I would get over my fear of them. And I was living in Philadelphia at the time as a single mom, so it wasn't a bad idea to have a gun.
Okay, very good. So then you move on to working for the New Jersey Department of Law and Public Safety in various yes. roles. As you get into the Economic Crime Bureau, money laundering section, counterterrorism, what was your favorite group to work with?
My favorite group to work with was the Financial Intelligence Unit. New Jersey had passed in 1996 a money laundering statute. So they were able to prosecute money laundering at the state level and not have to push everything up to the federal. And so we decided that we would try to put together, I think we had about five analysts, an attorney, two attorneys actually, and three or four investigators in this financial intelligence unit. And what we found was that there was significant reporting by the money service businesses in the state, such as check cashers and wire remitters, of currency transaction reports that we were by law required to get copies of as part of the Attorney General's office. We started looking at these. There were boxes and boxes of past ones that people had just kind of said, okay, we're supposed to get these, just put them over there in the corner. But we opened all the mail, we looked at every single one, and we started developing indicators. So when we looked at, for example, the amounts of money that people were cashing in the check cashers, the largest check I ever saw cashed at a hole-in-the-wall Jersey City check casher was $700,000. That is more than what you would expect. It was a check made on the California Medicaid system. You know, so it was a government check that wow. had been FedExed overnight from California to this hole in the wall in Jersey City to be cashed, you know, turned into to currency.
So they actually gave them $700,000 worth of currency?
Yes. So you might ask, well, how could they do that? How would they know to have it? The answer, of course, is that they were working with the people in California and knew that the check was coming. And so they had gone to the bank and gotten the appropriate amount of money. Of course, Jersey check cashers cash checks for usually about 2% of the face value mm-hmm. of the check. So what's 2% of 700,000?
Jeez, you're testing my math.
Maybe 35,000.
Yeah, there you go.
So would a check casher turn their back on something like that?
No.
That amount of profit? Heck no. We went through all of these and we found out that we were developing cases right, left, and center because there were so many checks that were 50,000, 100,000, 200,000, that would be very clearly questionable. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and deserving of investigation. We had so many of these that our investigators ran out of steam, and we would provide them to the county prosecutor's offices in New Jersey or to IRS because there was a lot of tax evasion that was involved. And also, we would provide them up to the New York District Attorney's Office, you know, Manhattan DA, because they are very excellent when it comes to going after money kind of cases. And we had, because of its proximity to New York, we had a number of New Yorkers coming across and doing their deed of getting rid of their check at one of our facilities rather than having it done in New York. So we were inundated by cases. We prosecuted a number of people. The fellow that I talked about with the $700,000 check, we eventually went to court over him and a few of his comrades. We were able to not just indict, but also convict a couple of the fellows. One of them pled out. The one that we particularly went after got a minimal sentence because, don't forget, it's a white-collar crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we had that. He got, I think, 364 days, which is a way of staying in a state prison rather than going off somewhere bigger. Unfortunately, he did the same thing several years later. By several, I mean three or four. Same setup in California, New Jersey, so on. This time, we worked with California, and we were able to get him a sentence. I believe his sentence ended up being about 28 years.
Nice.
So sometimes the wheels of justice grind slow, but they do their job.
Interesting. So in terms of the indicators, were there any indicators that surprised you that you developed, or maybe ones that aren't as maybe considered common sense?
Not common sense. Well, common sense, of course, is something to be valued. And certainly the amount of those checks was a commonsensical kind of thing. But we also saw that people would sometimes drive 50 miles to get a check cashed as opposed to go to the check casher that was just down the block. So we kind of wondered about that. We had one guy who claimed he was 90 years old, a check for like $100,000. And, you know, we kind of looked at it because of his age. We're like, you know, what's he doing schlepping around looking for a check casher? And it turned out it was someone who was about a quarter of his age that was actually cashing the check. Other not sensical ones. The problem is that sometimes people, they're cashing checks for multiple companies, but you don't really know that because they're using different identification. Or they're using their middle name and their last name instead of their first name and their last name. You know, various kinds of personal information changes. The checks, the companies on which the checks are made can be shell companies, that is, that have no real business reason. The most convoluted one I saw was a check casher who would cash the check and then one of his, as he called them, girls, that is the tellers that were working there, would take the money, go across the street to a real bank and get a cashier's check that they could then give the person, you know, walk back and give the person that had made the transaction. So they were taking a check, converting it to cash, converting it back to a check, but the name on it had nothing to do with the fellow that had walked in the door. Mm-hmm. I spoke to the owner of that company and told him that while his position was that he was just doing a service for his customers, that he was facilitating money laundering, but he did not agree with me. Nice guy.
And let me ask you this. What do you think law enforcement could do? Or maybe it's a change in law, or what is us as a society? What could we do to reduce money laundering?
Reduce money laundering. Well, I would say that we should not allow fictitious corporations and trusts, fictitious trusts, and, you know, the kind of money that is sent overseas now through international wires. I think there's something like $3 billion a day or something that is wired around the world. There are not very many preclusions against this. The Financial Action Task Force, which I widely admire, located in Paris, I would always love a job there. But they had their 40 recommendations. But there's no international law about money laundering. There are recommendations, there are suggestions. The insurers, the FDIC, the OCC, the Bank of International Settlements, all of those kind of people can refuse to do business with you. And this can have an impact, especially if you're a country like Iran, you know, people will not do business with you. That hurts. But I think there's always going to be money laundering because there's always going to be crime. And there's always going to be people that want more for themselves and they want to be able to hide it so they can make it appear to be legitimate and live the high life.
All right. So we got to move on now, unfortunately. So you retire from New Jersey and then you go on and take a career as an instructor with the DIA or working military intelligence as an instructor. So let's just talk about that transition. What was the feeling going into being an instructor for military intelligence?
I was very excited, Jason. I knew a few people who worked one who worked at DIA, a guy by the name of Russell Swenson, who has since retired, and a fellow who worked at NSA, the National Security Agency, David Moore. And I have met them several times, and they were kind of outside the box kind of people. And they were working in a military environment. And so I thought it surely would not be as constricted as I expected the military to be. You know, as I said, I have not had any dealings with military or police people in my youth. I was wrong. and the levels of protocol and propriety and all of those kinds of things. When I first arrived there, there were people who said, well, who the heck is she? She's never been a DIA analyst. She can't possibly know anything about analysis, and she's going to teach us. So the first course that I was given to teach was a course called Critical Thinking and Structured Analysis, CTSA, which relied very heavily on some booklets by some folks out in Berkeley, California, who were part of the critical thinking community and were professors and had nothing to do with the military or anyone else. And it was somewhat difficult. You know, some of the people in my classes didn't really think that I belonged there. And there were times when I wondered about that too, but I just kind of stuck with it. And I also noticed that there was no course at all at DIA on financial analysis. And I had been teaching since 96 or so, a class on financial analysis in New Jersey. And so I talked to my supervisor about it, and he said, well, you know, you already have a course, make it be more for the military and roll it out and see if anyone stands up and salutes it. And so I did. And it ended up being a counter threat finance course. It was one of the most popular courses they had.
Nice. You won them over.
Yeah. Well, the people in the field, the people that were out in the combatant commands who were going in and getting boxes of documents out of people's offices and houses, had no idea what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were very grateful for that particular training and the advice. I actually put together a guide to counter threat finance that DIA published at the time. And I still have, by the way, available, if people are interested in that kind of thing, I have it available on electronic form.
Okay. Well, we can put a link on our website and to the show notes so people can access it. All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about your badge story and ILEA and some advice for our audience. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Nadia Tuominen, and I just wanted to say, get off your cell phone. How are you going to be perceptive and observational if everything you perceive and observe is on a tiny rectangular screen? Not okay. Get off your cell phone.
Hi, this is Sheila Dorn. Do you want to build your credibility with field personnel, with police officers on the street? Get a candy dish. Put it on your desk and fill it with good candy. That's your opportunity to talk with people and engage. You can send out a million emails. People might know your name, but they don't really know you until you talk to them face to face. And that candy dish is an opportunity to talk with people and really get to know them.
Hi, this is Sean Fisher. And at my work, we're known as the Nerdery. And we're proud of it. Embrace who you are.
Welcome back, Marilyn. Now I want to talk about your badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the badge story is the career-defining project or case that an analyst works on. And for you, it's your work with ILEA, the International Association of Law Enforcement Intelligence Analysts. Let's just start from the beginning, getting started with your work with ILEA and talk about your contributions.
I chose ILEA as my badge story or career defining project because it was due to ILEA that I really got involved in the field, that I stayed in the field, and that I'm now doing volunteer work as a retiree and continuing to work with ILEA because I really, really believe in what it does and what it could do if it had people who were committed. In 1980, which really is when I kind of started on the field, when I was doing the 1980 report for the Crime Commission, there were very few analysts. There were some notable exceptions to that. New Jersey State Police had four or five analysts, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, California Department of Justice, Arizona Department of Law Enforcement, and all of those had pretty decent analytic efforts. But for everyone else, it was kind of a, what? What's an analyst? You know, they had clerks, they had secretaries, and that was about it. But what I found, so when I went to the Crime Commission and was switched over from being a special assistant for communications for the purpose of the crime report, the 1980 crime report, I was given a position as an analyst, but I wasn't really sure what to do and how to do it. And there was really no one there to tell me, which in some ways wasn't bad because I could kind of make stuff up myself. And that's what I did with a telephone record analysis and a number of other techniques that I do. I kind of took what I could find about them, but then I really created them as I thought they should be. Through ILEA, I was able to connect with a cadre of people who thought like me, who were interested in the same kinds of things, and who were maybe onesie or twosie analysts in county or even state level agencies that really, you know, were doing analysis, but weren't really getting a heck of a lot of guidance from their supervisors. I remember one supervisor saying to me, "Marilyn, I have no idea what you do, but you should keep doing it because people tell me that it's helpful to them." And so, you know, part of our job has been to train our supervisors.
Yes, yes.
As well as the people in the field. But what I found through first the newsletter and later through the journal, which was called the Law Enforcement Intelligence Analysis Digest in the 80s, and my local chapter in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, was the one that really started to work on it. And, you know, so I was writing articles for that. I was teaching across McLaughlin's 8-state region and sometimes being invited other places like California or Canada to teach. And, you know, so I had opportunities to teach, I had opportunities to write, I had opportunities to get feedback from other people in my field. And all of this was because of ILEA. And I think that it plays a very important role in the life of every analyst, whether they know it or not.
So ILEA turns 40 years old this year. When you look back to the 40-year history of ILEA and your contributions, what contributions do you think made the greatest impact on the profession?
Well, I was thinking a little bit about that because of the anniversary. And it struck me that during the 80s, Emma Fern from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement was the president of ILEA for several years. And she had the strongest influence then. She was a very practical person. And she was also, you know, a person who wanted ILEA to grow, but not so much that it would be outside of the control of the analyst. She was worried about intelligence officers joining or other kinds of people that might turn the heads of the current members. In the 90s really was the decade that I was the most influential. We had little booklets that we wrote about how to start an analyst unit, intelligence-led policing, best models of intelligence organizations, so on and so forth. And we would hand those out at the IACP meetings in the fall, which were attended by thousands of people. So, you know, that along with some of the writings that were done, my applications in criminal analysis that came out in 94, and the articles that I had in the journal along that time, and my teaching really, not just in the U.S., but in Australia, Germany, Bulgaria, England, etc. It was a very great period for me personally. I love the 96 to 2000 years when I was president. Every morning I woke up full of energy because I knew there were so many things that we could be doing that would make ILEA even better. And to be honest, I kind of miss that. We have the comradeship, and, you know, I really love being able to meet with and network with the people in Canada and the UK and France. And, you know, I think we have over 55 countries or so that have members of ILEA, and I want to work with them all. I've always believed in a worldwide society that helps each other and works with each other. At one point, I wanted to work for the United Nations, I remember. The fact that we can get together and we can share ideas and we can disagree, we can still continue working together it's really great for me to see that, you know, you don't have to be great. You don't have to really like someone to work with them. You can work with anyone. You can respect anyone who is doing a job, making a difference in the field.
Yeah. So as you were president back in the late 90s, then, I mean, I guess, what are some issues? What are some things that you're working through and that might have been up for debate as to what the direction of the association should go into?
Well, in 1990, we started the Society of Certified Criminal Analysts. We, meaning Richie Martinez, Glenn Ridgway, Emma Fern, a few others, and myself, Rob Fallman from Canada. We started SCCA. The reason we did was because there were a number of people in IALEA that thought you didn't need an education to be an analyst. And we wanted to draw a line in the sand that said, you need to have some education, whether it's a PhD, an MA, a BA, an associate's degree, whatever. You need something beside high school. And we were kind of casting about in our guidelines for SCCA. And we did say that if someone had been an analyst for like 10 years, they could still be an analyst without the education. But that was a big point because IALEA had a standards and accreditation committee that had gotten nowhere on that issue in 10 years, which is why we started SCCA. By the middle 90s, they not only agreed that they needed something like that, but they decided they should take it over. And so it was handed over to them. I'm sure there are people who question our activities with LEIU, the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit. We have our annual meetings with them. We used to have them with the International Association of Chiefs of Police. But I think that there have always been divergences of opinion about, well, what exactly should certification look like? How should the FIAT, the Foundations of Intelligence Analysis Training, be run? Why don't we have advanced analysis has always been one of my big questions. Why aren't there people willing to create such courses and make them available is an I wonder of mine. But, you know, I think that we really are still growing. We're still learning. And I think that as long as I'm around, I will do my best to make sure that still happens. And even after I'm around, I recently finalized a will where I'm going to leave a fund to IALEA to use for people who want to have training, a scholarship fund, that they will be able to designate people that can receive these funds. So I'm hoping to keep it going. I'm so darn proud that they are still going 40 years later. There are plenty of people who have said that analysis could be done as easily by a trooper with a computer as any of us. I don't agree with that, but that people do take that point of view. And I'm just glad we're still healthy, and I want us to keep thriving for as long as we can.
Just a point of clarification. So the SSCA, the certification, was taken over by IALEA. Is that correct?
Yes. It was not a hostile takeover.
Okay. So I think it is interesting, the education piece, because I can see those that don't have the education piece wanting to know how they accomplish the certification. And I can see by the time the 90s and 2000s roll around, the number of people with at least an associate's, it becomes more and more. So you have a bigger part of the population that has a degree. I could understand why it became to the point where, okay, we're more accepting of that requirement. And yeah, let's make it part of IALEA and let's bring over SSCA.
Well, exactly. And, you know, in the old days, in the 80s and the 70s, the 60s, whatever, there were few and far between online programs where you could get a degree online. Now, it's become the norm. Even colleges that are brick and mortar have offered courses that are online, and the students like them because they're more convenient. The fact that people say, oh, well, I couldn't get a degree because I didn't have the X, Y, or Z, you know, that excuse has kind of fallen away.
I also wanted to just thank you for all your contributions and the fact that you're sending up a memorial fund for future people to get the training that they want is just fantastic. So thank you for doing that.
You're very welcome, Jason.
And I also want to thank you personally as well, because you may not remember it, but you actually taught me how to be a trainer. I was one of those that were in the FIAT program way back when. You taught me how to teach the class. I forget the year, but we were in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I want to say it was with you, Elise Dukoschak, and Ed Polachek. Is that his last name, Polachek?
Yeah, Ed Polachek, yeah. Yeah, he was the height of diving.
Yes. So those three were the three instructors and great influence for me, you know, eventually doing a lot of teaching over the years. So thank you for teaching me.
Well, you're very welcome. And I have a son whose name is John, and he writes books. And the first book that he wrote under his autograph to my mother for teaching me to write. He didn't say teaching how to write, but that I had taught him to write. I thought that was very meaningful and touching, because growing up with me, he saw my love of books and my interest in writing, and he took it on himself. And he has written 5 or 6 books in the last 10 years or so. And, you know, I couldn't be more proud of him.
Fantastic. So I just have a couple more questions for you in terms of the advice and the law enforcement analysis profession as a whole. As you look back at your career in teaching all these years and doing all this analysis, what are you surprised that the law enforcement analysis profession hasn't figured out yet?
Well, I think I alluded before to the fact that there's really no advanced analytic training. To me, this is a tremendous gap in what should be happening. We should be, you know, adult learners. We should be lifelong learners. It's really something that we should constantly be doing. And that's one of the reasons I teach, is because every time I teach, I learn something from the learners in the class, or I learn something from the materials that I have put together to teach the class. So it is very important to me to keep learning. I may have the opportunity to try to figure out how to solve that problem.
Well, that'd be good, because I always struggle with that. When I put in for a conference to teach, I'm like, okay, I want to teach an advanced course or an advanced presentation, but where do I start? Right? If you start as a beginner, well, you're just giving them the basics, right? You know where to start. You're starting from the ground up. But when you teach intermediate or advanced classes, you have to establish a baseline, a prerequisite, and that becomes difficult in a lot of ways.
You are right. And, you know, we at ILEA, it's relatively easy to say, well, FIAT is the baseline. FIAT is the entry level training. So anything that goes beyond that. But, you know, some people think that advanced training is computerized, that you can't do advanced training unless you have some super fancy software program that you're doing it in. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily agree with that. We could have a whole talk devoted to the difference between network analysis and social network analysis, which is better or worse. But that aside, I would say that to me, advanced training is more in depth, which means you're not going to be giving it in a 60 to 90 minute piece at a conference. When I did a strategic analysis piece at ILEA a few years ago, I had pre-reading, I had an exercise they had to do after the class, and we had a four-hour block at the conference, so it was maybe 6 hours worth of training. But our analytic standards do say that people need to get advanced training every year. We need to figure that out, figure out how we can give it.
Yeah. Besides getting advanced training or developing advanced training, what advice do you have for experienced analysts?
So my advice is that you should share your knowledge and your passion for truth, justice, in the analytic way, because you are going to be the people that the newer generation looks up to see where they should be going. And the experienced analysts need to step up and become mentors or write things or work with people at their agency so that we have a thoughtful and passionate group of newbies coming up.
Yeah. And then what about for newer analysts? What advice do you have for them?
Be a sponge. Read everything you can find, get your hands on. It doesn't have to be just about criminal intelligence analysis. One of the first pieces I ever wrote in 1986 was in the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence. What it did was it talked about the kind of analysis that is done in strategic analysis in the national security realm and how this applies to law enforcement. I was starting to extend my arms into other areas to find things that would be helpful to us in our area. That's another I wonder. Strategic analysis is very seldom done in this country. You know, there are a few places that it's done for things like inaugurations and sporting events and like the Super Bowl and such, but in the day-to-day kind of world, there's very little done. And I don't understand. In Europe, they do it. In Canada, they do it. In Australia, they do it, but not here.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think that they are still being reactive and, you know, reacting to crimes that have occurred rather than looking at the potential of threats, whether they are political threats or financial threats or threats from burglars or whatever. There's all kinds of things you can do strategic analysis on and, you know, see if you can come up with some better way of doing things. That's the whole point. But a lot of times agencies are mired in, we've always done it that way.
Yes, they do. All right. Well, our last section to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word and you can promote any idea that you want to. Marilyn, what are your words to the world?
I would say, to borrow a phrase from a guy who's even older than I am, namely Michelangelo, I would say, ancora in paro, which is a little plaque I have here in my home office. And he said that when he was 86. And it means I'm still learning. If I can learn at least one thing every day, it makes my life complete. And I hope that you all can learn every day too.
Excellent. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Marilyn. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
You're very welcome, Jason. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.